I guess the first thing to do is to define what cosmic justice is, as distinguished from whatever other kind of justice we may be familiar with. Traditional justice, I guess we can summarize, at least in the American tradition, as applying the same rules and the same standards to everybody. Cosmic justice is very different. It means equalizing the prospects of everybody. And those two things are not only different in concept, they are wholly incompatible with one another. If you apply the same rules and standards to everybody in baseball, Mark McGwire is going to hit 70 home runs, and there are going to be other people who will spend an entire career without hitting 70 home runs, including people in the Hall of Fame like Luke Appling, who twice won the batting championship. So if you want the one thing or the other, you can go for it. But the one thing you cannot do is pursue the two things simultaneously. Or rather, you cannot successfully do that. The Supreme Court has been pursuing the two things simultaneously for quite a while, leading to a lot of 5-4 decisions and inconsistent decisions. The requirements for the two kinds of justice are very different. The requirement for treating everyone the same is very simple. It's mass-produced. The requirements for cosmic justice must be handmade and tailored to each individual case. It's much more complex, and it requires a much larger amount of government power. Some third party must intervene to determine whether the outcomes are right, whether the prospects are right. The very same words have entirely different meanings within these two frameworks. In fact, as I mentioned in the preface to the book, what really set me off a few years ago to finish it up was a discussion with one of my colleagues at Stanford University, who shall be anonymous in deference to the libel laws, who talked about a level playing field. And it became painfully clear that what he called a level playing field is what I would have called a tilted playing field, tilted so as to produce the results that he wanted. When we talk about a fair fight, that means very different things within these two frameworks. A fair fight, by traditional standards, means that both boxers observe the Marquess of Queensberry rules, and the fight is fair whether it ends up in a draw or a one-sided beating. From the other point of view, from the cosmic perspective, it's fair only when the two fighters enter the ring with the same prospects of winning. John Rawls has sort of summarized and epitomized these two differences. He distinguishes what he calls fair equality of opportunity from merely formal equality of opportunity. Traditional justice, or fairness, by Rawls's standards, means simply that people are judged by the same rules. But genuine equality of opportunity, as he calls it, cannot be achieved by this method. Instead, he says, undeserved inequalities call for redress. And obviously, someone must have power in order to do that redress. Now, what I call cosmic justice has been called by some people social justice. But I think they're unduly modest, because they're trying to correct not only the inequities that they see in society, they're trying to correct the oversights of God or the defects of the cosmos. When some people are born with physical or mental handicaps, they want to counterbalance that. And of course, that's not always caused by society. So that when Rawls says that undeserved inequalities, he includes all sorts of things. And that opens up a very large area for others. You can find this perspective on justice, the Rawlsian perspective, in many places, from the street corner community activist right up to the chambers of the Supreme Court. For example, a few years ago, an admissions director at Stanford University wrote a book in which she pointed out that during all her years as an admissions director, she had never required students to submit achievement tests, because some of those students, she said, through no fault of their own, attended schools where they could not have acquired the skills necessary to do well on such tests. So she's trying to redress the inequalities, and therefore she would simply not require such tests. The Educational Testing Service is currently engaging in a renorming of test scores to take into account the social backgrounds and handicaps of the students, so that the score will then, again, redress pre-existing inequalities rather than applying the same standards to everybody. Whenever I hear the notions of fairness in education, I think back to my own education. And I think, thank God, my teachers were unfair to me when I was a kid growing up in Harlem. One of these teachers was a lady named Miss Simon, who belonged to what might be called the General Patton School of Education. I cannot even imagine that Miss Simon gave a moment's thought to my self-esteem. Every word that we misspelled in her class had to be written 50 times, not in class, but as part of our homework, and there was always plenty of other homework from her and other teachers. And so you misspell four or five words, and you had quite an evening ahead of you. Very little chance of listening to the Lone Ranger. Now, was this fair in Rawlsian terms? And the answer is no. Like many of the children in Harlem at that time, I came from a home where nobody had gone beyond elementary school. I still remember what a big fuss was made when I was promoted to the seventh grade because I'd gone further than anyone else. In later years, when I graduated from Harvard, there was no such fuss. They expected me to. But fairness was never an option. There was nothing Ms. Simon or anybody else could do about the fact that we came from homes where we did not have books and magazines, and we were not as familiar with those words as people from other neighborhoods might have been. So that was never an option. Nothing that the schools could have done would have changed that. It would have been an irresponsible self-indulgence for them to have pretended to make things fair. If there's anything worse than unfairness, it is make-believe fairness. They could, like the College Board apparently is trying to do, pretended that we knew more than we did. And that would have made them feel good. It would not have done much for us. Instead, they forced us to meet standards that were a little harder for us to meet than they were for some other kids, but far more necessary for us to meet, because that was the only way out of poverty. Many years later, I happened to run into one of the other kids from Harlem who went to that same school at the same time. And by now, he was a psychiatrist. He owned a home in the Napa Valley and property out there. In fact, now he's retired, living overseas with servants, while yours truly is still trying to make a living. But as we reminisced about things that had happened in the old days and what had happened in between, one of the things he mentioned was that over the years, his various secretaries had commented on the fact that he seldom misspelled a word. I told him that my secretaries had made that very same observation, and that if they knew Miss Simon, there would be no mystery as to why we did not misspell words. Now, it so happens I became a high school dropout. But what I was taught before I dropped out was enough for me to score higher on the verbal SAT than the average Harvard student, which may have had something to do with my being admitted to Harvard in an era before affirmative action was even thought of. What if the teachers of that era had been imbued with the present-day conception of fairness? Where would my schoolmate and I be today? On welfare, in prison, perhaps in a halfway house if we were lucky? And would that not have been an injustice? To take individuals capable of independent, self-supporting, and self-directed women and men with pride in their own achievements and turn them into dependents, clients, supplicants, mascots. Now, the primary purpose of mascots is to minister, to symbolize something that makes other people feel good. The actual fate of the mascot himself is seldom a major consideration. The argument here is not against real justice or real equality. Both of these things are desirable in themselves. The only argument is that some versions of these things are simply impossible, and that trying the impossible has costs and real dangers as well. After all, the people who manned the communist movement around the world before the Soviet Union was established didn't devote themselves to this cause for the sake of creating gulags and secret police and territorial aggrandizement. They did it because they were seeking social justice. But what actually happened shows some of the costs and some of the dangers of that. Most ordinary Americans still have the traditional conception of justice. And that means the people who have this cosmic notion of justice must misrepresent what is happening as being a violation of traditional justice. And therefore, they must, for example, misrepresent test results as being either arbitrary barriers to advancement or deliberate efforts to perpetuate inequalities. As Joseph Schumpeter once said, the first thing a man will do for his ideals is lie. The next thing he will do, and this is my addendum, is character assassination. Those people who disagree with those with the vision of cosmic justice must be stopped, in their view, by all means necessary. And that, of course, includes character assassination. They must be bought, to use a verb of our time. Now, the people who are the victims of this atmosphere of character assassination are not simply those who are targeted. The whole society is a victim, because you're not going to be able to attract into the public arena people who value their privacy, who value protecting their families from humiliations, if, in fact, disagreements become simply grounds for smears. In a sense, the people who are caught up in the vision of cosmic justice are also victims. Because once having demonized other people, they really cannot go back to square one and re-examine the evidence and find out whether what they've been advocating has been producing the results they want or producing totally different results. And so they're locked into the vision. They have too much of a stake in it to ever think about doing something different. I have a chapter in the book called The Tyranny of Visions about how the vision becomes more real to people than any empirical reality. A classic example was one described by Paul Johnson, Lenin. And Johnson pointed out that Lenin, although he spoke of himself as a representative of the proletariat, had in fact never set foot in a working class neighborhood in any of the cities he'd ever been in, inside or outside of Russia. He had never talked with the workers and had no idea what they believed about anything. He also, after becoming the ruler of Russia, never set foot in Soviet Central Asia, which is an area larger than all of Western Europe, and in which all these doctrinaire schemes from Moscow were imposed for nearly three quarters of a century, with devastating results. What he was devoted to was the vision, not flesh and blood people. A flesh and blood people were a complication on the road to realizing the vision. And as it turned out, if he had to kill a few million of those, that was just so much too bad. And of course, we've seen Hitler, Mao, and others with the same approach. Now, fortunately, we have thus far in this country had much more milder versions of this. But you can see also this notion of looking for visions and the abstractions that go with those visions rather than with flesh and blood people. The vision of cosmic justice is very beneficial to the people who hold it, even if it's not beneficial to those whom it's intended to benefit. And I think that's one of the reasons that people are so reluctant to give it up, because they feel wonderful. I'm sure that if we had had the kinds of teachers that we have today, and they had lowered the standards to all of us as we were coming through the school, and we all ended up going out into the world foredoomed to failure, those teachers would have felt wonderful about themselves. Because they say, hey, we're not leaning on these poor kids. We're taking into account that they come from backgrounds that are deprived. I mean, and particularly in education, this is devastating, because it's been shown again and again that in one generation, people can do remarkable things with a decent education. Jaime Escalante did this out in California with the Hispanic kids who scored so high on the calculus test that the Educational Testing Service could not believe it. So an awful lot can be done. Language is the same thing, the whole notion that you have to have bilingualism. Well, it's known from a lot of research that the child's brain is better able to assimilate languages in those first half dozen years than it will ever be able to do in later life. That the brain itself metamorphoses. And if you don't learn a foreign language until you're 30, you're never going to speak it as well as if you'd learned it when you were five. And so all these things can be done. But they're not going to be done as long as third parties think that the purpose of the educational system is to make them feel good about themselves.